Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Abby Williams, Vice President of the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I am pleased to welcome you to this event on security and democracy in Pakistan, which the Institute is co-hosting with CSIS. I think this event is another example of our excellent collaboration with CSIS, and I should like to thank CSIS for making their facilities available to us. Unfortunately, Karen Van Hippel, who is here at CSIS and was going to be the co-chair at this event, unfortunately is unable to join us. So you will have a solo anchor in me instead of having co-anchors. I'm delighted to see so many people here, which is a clear demonstration of your interest in the subject of today's panel. The disintegration of the ruling coalition in Pakistan has undermined efforts to construct a democratic polity capable of addressing escalating economic, social, and security challenges in the country and in the wider region. We also, of course, have the question of whether there is a prospect of a reaccession of the military. But we also meet here, of course, in the wake of the appointment of a new president of Pakistan. So it will be interesting to see what that might mean, both for the country and for its relations with its neighbors and in the wider region. USIP and CSIS have assembled an outstanding group of experts to examine the challenges facing Pakistan and their implications for U.S.-Pakistani relations. And I will now introduce them very briefly in the order in which they will speak. Sujan Nawaz is a member of USIP's study group on reform and security in the Muslim world. His latest book is Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within, which was published this year by Oxford University Press. And he will discuss the role of the military in Pakistan. Peter Manikas is a senior associate and regional director for Asia programs at NDI, and he will address the question of democracy in Pakistan. And Marvin Weinbaum is a resident scholar at the Middle East Institute. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois, and he will examine the regional implications of Pakistan's current domestic political scene. And Daniel Bromberg, who is the acting director of the Muslim World Initiative at the U.S. Institute of Peace, will be our discussant, and Dan will react to the points raised by the three presenters. I've asked them each to limit their opening remarks to no more than 12 minutes. Then I will open the floor to all of you. You came here, I'm sure, to be active participants in this event, and we welcome that. When you're recognized and you take the floor, I hope you'll give us your name and affiliation. Again, thank you very much for being here, and I should ask Sujan to take the floor.
Thank you, Abhi. I'm glad to be here. I consider CSIS my home also, in addition to my association with USIP. And it's good to see so many familiar faces. Marvin and I always joke at these events that it's the usual suspects. And I think that makes for a good conversation at the end of our presentations. I was asked to speak about the role of the military in Pakistan today. And really, the role of the military has to be seen against the context of what Pakistan as a polity is facing today and what the interaction between the army, which is the single largest component of the military, how it relates to the polity of Pakistan, where are we headed. Today, I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that Pakistan is facing an existential threat, and that probably the future of Pakistan rests on what happens in the country within the next few years. And the threat this time is not so much external as it is internal, because for the first time since the civil war in 1971, by which Pakistan lost half the country in East Pakistan, and you had the birth of Bangladesh, we are finding today a large-scale insurgency that is encompassing Pakistan, and it is not just confined to the federally administered tribal areas, but it has seeped over into the settled area of the Northwest Frontier Province, and the numerous attacks as well as suicide bombings that have occurred even in the capital and in Rawalpindi, and attacks on the military in particular in Sargodha, as well as the most recent one on the Wa Ordnance Factory, are all an indication of the extent to which the society of Pakistan is now going through tremendous tumult and turmoil. And what is making this very difficult is that there does not appear to be any consensus yet, nor any public debate or discussion on what kind of Pakistan do we want in the country, neither among the politicians nor among the intelligentsia. It is almost as if we are flailing around looking for a solution and trying to find someone to blame for it without trying to understand that what is happening, particularly in the Northwest, is really a result of the history of Pakistan. It's a history of neglect of the region, particularly of Fatah, and we are now paying the price for that, because given the right set of circumstances, Pakistan becomes a petri dish for militancy and for worldwide terrorism. The presence of Al-Qaeda has acted as a kind of a starter in this process, because they had the knowledge and the expertise, and that is now increasingly being seen in the kind of loose franchise arrangements that have occurred between Al-Qaeda, the Afghan Taliban, and the Tehreek-e-Taliban of Pakistan, and more dangerous in recent months, particularly evidence of the relationship between the right-wing Sunni extremist groups from central and southern Punjab, who have become complicit in this militancy, and who have added another dimension to their previous role, which was as surrogates for Pakistan in Kashmir in the independent struggle against India that was being waged for many years. This group has also added another dimension in the sense that it has added to the tensions between the conflict between the Shia and the Sunni in the Northwest Frontier Province, and in Fatah in particular, in the Khurram Agency in the area of Parachinar. You find the Sunni extremists from the Punjab training and fighting against the Shia. And another foreign element that comes into play, which is you have a proxy war that is being waged between Iran and Saudi Arabia using the Shia and Sunni extremists as their proxies. So it's against this background that one has to look at the role of the military and the army, and also recognize that we are coming out of 8 years of autocratic rule, 8 years when you had an army chief who was also the president of Pakistan, that was General Pervez Musharraf, and you had the army totally embroiled in the political system and in the bureaucracy of Pakistan, with well over 200 senior army officials inducted into the civilian bureaucracy, and just total control over the whole country, with all control basically vested in one man. The new army chief, General Ashfaq Parvez Kiani, has announced that he wants to take the army back to its professional roots, but he's going to face an uphill task, largely because of the big expectations that have been built up over the years of the role of the army. And politicians who complain about the army are often the first to try and provoke the army into coming on one side or the other when they fight their political games in Islamabad. Now, the army is also facing a serious problem because it has taken quite a hit, particularly in Fatah, where the Frontier Corps, which is not a regular part of the army but is associated with the army and where the officers all come from the Pakistan Army, has not performed well. And it has not performed well because over the years, the Frontier Corps was allowed to deteriorate so that it was not even an effective policing force, which was its original role under the British and which continued to be the role under Pakistan after 1947. Moreover, because of the association with a single man, General Pervez Musharraf, the respect for the army went down among the general population in Pakistan, and this for an institution that always occupied the top spot when polls were conducted about which institution do you admire the most. It was always the Pakistan Army number one and then the rest. In the past 2 years, that changed dramatically. And so you had, in the wake of popular unrest and civil society unrest, you had the army, which was seen as propping up Musharraf, being his main base and his political party, dropping from first to third place behind journalists and lawyers. And this, I think, has shaken up the military tremendously. This, plus the fact that the Frontier Corps was surrendering in large numbers and that they suffered very heavy casualties, over 1,000 persons killed in the action, much more than, say, the forces in Afghanistan have lost in this period. So today we are in a situation where we have a civilian government, and unfortunately it faces an uphill task because history goes against it. According to the history of Pakistan, whenever a civilian government has taken over from a dictatorship or an autocratic government, it has found it very difficult to divest itself of many of the tools and the symbols of power that the previous government had. So a big challenge that will be facing President Asif Ali Zardari now is to what extent is he going to give up those powers that Musharraf had basically taken unto himself. And in the process, Musharraf had transformed what was a parliamentary democracy or a constitution that was supposed to be for a parliamentary democracy into effectively a presidential system, with all the power resting in him because he believed in unity of command. So you're going to face a serious issue within the civilian establishment, and there will be problems. As Abi noted, the coalition has already split. As of this morning, Mr. Zardari has instructed the Prime Minister to replace all the ministers from the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz group. This was the second string that had been deputed to the government in recent weeks, and even they will be gone. And so it will be essentially a Pakistan People's Party-dominated government. The other issue is for the security of Pakistan, is the army really equipped to deal with the situation that it faces, which is a war within Pakistan? This is an army that has been trained and set up and organized to fight conventional wars, not unlike the United States Army was before it got involved with Iraq. And it was always looking east towards India. And as a result, you had very large land-based army, and it was increasingly a burden on the economy and on society. Suddenly it is being faced with an internal militancy and an insurgency and a low-intensity conflict for which it is not ready. It doesn't have the training. It doesn't have the capacity, meaning it doesn't have the tools. And under pressure from the United States, for the first time since independence in 1947, the Pakistan Army moved into Fatah, into the federally administered tribal area, where, because it is predominantly a Punjabi force, it is seen as an alien force. And this doesn't sit well either with the locals, nor does it sit well with the army. And they're in a hurry to try and find a way to equip the frontier corps and to make them more capable so that the army can then withdraw back to its normal peacetime positions. But, you know, if they do that too soon, then the frontier corps will not be ready, and you'll basically be ceding space to the militants, and they will declare their emirate or caliphate or whatever, and then you have a kind of a permanent base for the militants in the west of Pakistan, which will create more problems because it will provoke much more unfettered U.S. attacks across the border. Currently, because the army is still in Fatah, I think any large-scale incursions by NATO or U.S. are deterred. But we can see that, in recent weeks, the U.S. is testing the boundaries and testing to see how this new government acts or reacts. Now, another issue that affects the security of Pakistan is the situation with India itself. To give credit to President Musharraf, from a man who launched an adventure in the wastes of Kargil, which almost brought India and Pakistan to war in 1999, he definitely opened the doors to peace and tried to lower the temperature between India and Pakistan. And things had opened up. In fact, the line of control in Kashmir is now the scene of many transfers of people coming to visit relatives across the border. And according to some of the more recent indications, because of internal difficulties within Kashmir and in the links between Kashmir and the rest of India, there's a demand to reopen the shorter and easier route between Srinagar and Rawalpindi, which was used by the British before 1947, before they left and India and Pakistan became independent. You now have, because of some ill-considered moves on the part of the Indian government in Kashmir, you have a spontaneous combustion that has taken place, and the freedom and independence movement has now taken on a new dimension, which is creating a serious problem. And this problem is people are taking advantage of it, particularly the right-wing militant groups, the Sunni groups that I mentioned earlier that were based in Pakistan, that previously were used by the ISI as surrogates in Kashmir. And they are now, since they're no longer under the tutelage of the ISI, they're now independent, and they are infiltrating into Kashmir and taking advantage of the situation. Moreover, you have a homegrown Muslim insurgency or militancy among the student movement within India, and if there are any links established between the militant groups from Punjab in Pakistan and these groups, then the danger exists for a new conflagration between India and Pakistan. And I think that is something that not just these two countries, but the world needs to be very careful about. It seriously affects the security situation. In terms of defending the homeland, the army is equipped, but only conventionally. I think the big challenge will be, can they defend the homeland by fighting the militancy within? And a big question that is now raised about the army itself is, because of its changing recruitment patterns and because of the role of the Islamists, particularly during the period of General Ziaul-Haq, you have a lot of new officers who have now been recruited primarily from the cities and from the petty bourgeoisie of the cities. These are now rising to command levels, and the question now will be whether General Kiani will be able to use his filters to ensure that these officers remain conservative or religious but do not cross over to the radical side of the spectrum. These are the kinds of issues that we'll be facing and which will determine Pakistan's security in the years ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shuja. I turn the microphone to Peter.
Thank you very much, Abhi. Just by way of background, the National Democratic Institute has been working in Pakistan since 1988. I first went there in 1990, so I have about 18 years of involvement with the country. Although political party work is generally central to the work that we do, it's only been over the last 5 or 6 years that we've actually been funded to work directly with the political parties. A lot of our work has been intermittent, really around elections. So our work with political parties hasn't been sustained over a long period of time. We could actually talk about that a bit more later, because the international community has been very reluctant to engage political parties, and that was really demonstrated during the past election. But we could talk about that a bit more. I recently saw Henry Kissinger on a panel just a couple of days ago talking about Pakistan, and his point, I guess, was that he was really lamenting the current state of affairs and the return to power of the political parties that were generally viewed as corrupt and feckless and unlikely to generate the kind of political support that is going to be needed to keep them in power. You know, at first I was somewhat appalled given the situation that the international community, and particularly the United States, is now in, having supported President Musharraf for 9 years at the expense of democracy in Pakistan. But as I thought of it, it seemed to me that he was actually making an important point. If the international community remains somewhat passive and watches the new dispensation sort of just proceed as it naturally might, we could be repeating the same cycles that we saw in past years, the civilian governments sort of losing the support after years of sort of exploiting the country and engaging in sort of massive corrupt behavior, followed by just another military intervention. There's a lot of things I think that the international community might do to discourage and help prevent that. But whether they do so, I think, remains to be seen. The elections of February, I think, raised a lot of hopes, particularly with the formation of the governing coalition that seemed poised to initiate a political reconciliation that was long needed. Clearly, it didn't last very long. Within 3 months, the Nawaz had withdrawn his ministers, and just after 6 months or so, the coalition falls apart over essentially two issues, one of which was the restoration of the judges, 60 of whom were removed by President Musharraf, and the selection of the next president. The coalition itself, I think, was viewed by many as really the best hope for setting Pakistan on its new democratic path. Everyone was quite hopeful, I think, that by the political parties acting in concert, they could actually begin to mobilize public opinion around the growing militancy and attack a lot of the problems that were social and economic problems that were plaguing the country. And the growing militancy obviously is not confined to the tribal areas. I mean, I was just struck when I was there during the past election to see how close to Islamabad the militancy had grown, and what portions of the Northwest Frontier Province were actually sort of beyond the control of the central government. It wasn't confined to Swat, and it wasn't confined to the northern parts of the NWFP. but really essentially the suburbs of Islamabad itself. With the political parties acting in concert, they could have mobilized, I think, public opinion to help address those issues. So clearly it's not a good thing, although I don't think it's necessarily catastrophic for this coalition to have failed. It wasn't a natural thing in any case. The enmity between Nawaz and Zardari had been longstanding. Countries don't usually have coalitions that consist of the two largest parties in the country. So it wasn't entirely unexpected that it would fail. It will make it more difficult, I think, to address the problems that I mentioned and that Shuja mentioned as well. But still, I think it's not necessarily the demise of the incipient democracy that's developing. One of the early tests, I think, as to whether this is really going to be a disaster is whether Zardari fulfills his promise to curtail the powers of the president through a constitutional amendment. And Nawaz is going to have to, I think, to act as a responsible and loyal opposition. These are not natural roles for these political leaders to take, and it's going to require a great deal of encouragement, I think. But we'll, only the future, I think, is going to tell us how things are really going to develop. It seems to me very important that the international community sort of confront some of the problems that Pakistan faces really head on. I mean, there are two things that could really derail the new democratic process. One is a return to the massive corruption that we had in the past. There's a lot of things I think that could be done to help support efforts in on the anti-corruption front, and I suspect that the international community will be eager to do that. The second problem I think is going to be a bit more difficult, which is to discourage the military from intervening once again. I suppose that some features favor that not happening. In the past, there are people here that are more knowledgeable about the Pakistan's military than I am, but it seems to me that in the past, either one of the parties or the civil bureaucracy has supported an intervention by the military. It's usually sort of been triggered by a president who aligned with the military dissolving the civilian government. I think that's not likely with the two leaders that we currently have, neither one of which I think is going to be very amenable to military intervention and are unlikely to view it as being favorable to themselves. There are some reasons, I think, to be reasonably hopeful about the coming months, and perhaps even in the longer term. As bad as the parties are, and everybody can agree that they are, in fact, very susceptible to corruption and have been sort of disinterested in the problems of ordinary Pakistanis. They do have a certain strength. I mean, they're frequently described by people who work in this area as being very weak organizations. I think that's a mischaracterization, actually, because there's a certain strength that all these parties have, I mean, particularly the two major ones. I mean, they survived while their leaders were in exile for the last 9 years. They kept their structures intact. They were able to mobilize people sort of on and off. They were clearly the major victims of the military regime. Their supporters were jailed and often beaten. Nevertheless, they could come back after 9 years of having been marginalized and organize and win an election. I mean, that seemed to me to indicate some degree of capacity that the parties had have. And the task, it would seem to me, is to turn that into a more positive direction than it had in the past. There's a number of other strengths. I mean, every political opinion survey that I've seen over the last several years indicates that Pakistanis overwhelmingly favor a democratic form of government. Every time they're permitted in a relatively free election to vote, they also vote in a very religiously moderate way, as we saw in the past election, which was consistent with other elections except for the immediate past election, in which the major parties had sort of been completely marginalized and the MMA coalition did quite well. That was really very unusual and really just sort of reflected the imbalance in the playing field. The legal community has clearly indicated that they're able and willing to act in support of an independent judiciary. And that's an incredibly important thing, I think. There's a growing news media that's eager to sort of exercise its rights of free expression, and a growing middle class that's not only interested in economic security but also the political stability that requires a certain degree of moderation in how they're being governed. And, you know, what can the international community do to help support all this? I think there are, you know, several things that are often done in situations like that, but support for the modernization and internal democracy within the parties, aid to civil society, helping to strengthen the institutions of governance like both the national and provincial legislatures, as well as the judicial system. Opening up the tribal areas to sort of normal political activity, I think, is being considered, and I think would be a very important step. But again, I think the two major things that have to be confronted is efforts to reduce corruption and discouraging the military from further interventions. I mean, I think everybody has to be very sort of open and candid about those two things, or we're going to see sort of a repeat of the cycles that have been prevalent in the past. You know, everybody's paying, not only the United States, but the international community generally is paying a very heavy price for their support of Musharraf over the past 9 years. And the prevailing view is that the United States tried to protect its own democracy at the expense of Pakistan's. Nevertheless, I think in conferences like this, certainly, I mean, ones that are held all throughout Washington, democracy and security are always coupled, which it's fine in one sense. Obviously, the two are related. Obviously, we think that the advance of democracy in Pakistan will, in fact, help ensure our own security. But we have to be very careful, I think, in regard to how we talk about that to Pakistanis. It's very difficult to recruit people in Pakistan to participate in your programs and support U.S. initiatives if they think that the only reason you're doing that is to help yourself and not them. There has to be a way of framing this so that we're talking about helping Pakistanis and doing what's best for Pakistan, not only because it helps us, but because it's really a key to their own interest. One way of doing that, I think, is to communicate to the people of Pakistan that we're really in this for the long term, that we're going to be committed to helping them develop a sustainable democratic process and work with them on their social and economic problems in the years to come. With that, I think I'll close.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter. I'll now give the floor to Marvin Weinbaum, who will discuss the regional implications of Pakistan's current domestic political scene.
Thank you. Regional influences and factors have always affected the political consciousness and the political dialogue in Pakistan. The most obvious to all of us is the way India and its perceived designs on Pakistan has been used over Pakistan's history by elites, both civilian and military, as a national unifier. And specifically, we often note the manipulation of public attitudes and emotions on the Kashmir issue. Now, the Kashmir, naturally, as a insurgency, spawned government-backed jihadi groups that fueled the insurgency in Kashmir, but also injected a religious extremism into Pakistan. India's nuclear program begot Pakistan's as a nuclear state as well. It had an impact in that it brought one of those few issues on which there is largely a consensus in Pakistan on a public issue, in support, of course, of the nuclear program. Over the longer time, Pakistan's asymmetrical relationship with India and the security concerns that are identified with that have justified the privileged position of the military in the society, and also fixed the military's ascendance over civilian political leadership for most of Pakistan's history. Now, we turn to Afghanistan again, looking back before we look at the present. There's no question but that the conflicts that existed in the 80s, the jihad of the 80s, extended the political life of General Zia. And we have every reason to believe that Musharraf's political longevity in this decade have not been unrelated to the conflict in Afghanistan. Pakistan's relentless determination to have a friendly and, if at all possible, subservient neighbor has been held responsible, rightly so, for three decades of radicalizing various segments of Pakistan's society and transforming particularly its border areas. Now, that process of transformation of border areas has been going on for some time. Certainly, it began in the 80s. It went through the Taliban period of the 90s. It was when guns and money flooded this area and replaced here the authority structures that exist. But certainly in 2001 plus, what we have seen is that continuation and culmination of the process in where we have virtually a state within a state, which is not unrelated to the fact that the Afghan Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and dissident Mujahideen groups have taken up residence in this area and have accelerated this process of transformation and radicalization. During all of this period of the jihad in the 90s and so on, we've seen within Pakistan itself a rise in domestic violence, a breakdown in law and order, the so-called Kalashnikov culture of guns and drugs, which is understandably largely attributed to what has been going on in Afghanistan. And, of course, for many Pakistanis becomes an excuse as to why they have the problem, saying it was not ours at all. It was something which was imposed on us by international efforts in Afghanistan. I should also mention that economically, Afghanistan has an impact. And part of it has been a drain on their budget, but it also has been a boon, particularly to the Northwest Frontier Province. You had only to see Peshawar before, say, the Afghan, the jihad, to see a sleepy town and to look at it today as anything but that. And there's always been a regional dimension then. Here I mention here about the effect on the Northwest Frontier Province and Fatah, the federally administered tribal areas. That kind of impact of Afghanistan has been less pronounced elsewhere in the country. And the same way with regard to Kashmir. We think of the Kashmir problem as something which has great salience throughout Pakistan. Not so. It has far greater salience naturally in Azad Kashmir and in the Punjab, and considerably less when we look at Sindh and the Northwest Frontier. And then there's a distinction here to be made between urban and rural, despite the fact that now means of communication have opened up opportunities for awareness in the rural area. Nevertheless, that exists, as well as between the chattering classes of the middle class and the rest of society in terms of their consciousness about the external or regional world here. Now, looking at the political discourse today, many Pakistanis who normally had little interest in regional international affairs have become far greater aware, politicized by what has been going on on its borders. We are seeing, as you recognize now, associated with this, a level of anti-Americanism that we have not seen before. There's always been suspicion of the United States, but one has to spend a couple of hours in Pakistan, if that, and talk to people to see the degree here of amnes toward America and its policies. And it has spawned conspiracy theories, which I think have to be admired for their creativity. Naturally, in the most recent period, we have to credit the demise of Musharraf over the last year and a half. Yes, in large part to the what he did vis-a-vis the Supreme Court, but the building resentment against Musharraf and his association with the military operations in the frontier and the war in Afghanistan certainly have become, across Pakistan, a reason why Musharraf lost popularity. In a recent IRI survey, International Republican Institute, only 15% agreed with the proposition, 15%, that the U.S. should cooperate, that Pakistan should cooperate with the U.S. in its war on terrorism. But when they were asked if they agreed with Prime Minister Gilani's, this was a June survey, Gilani's assertion that the elimination of terrorism should have the highest priority for Pakistan's own sake as the war on terror and not as America's war, 81% agreed. What we've got here, and it's confusing, we've got here a kind of disconnect. On one hand, the people of Pakistan do not share the values of the extremists, of the militants, not at all. And as been pointed out here, and they demonstrate this in the way they vote and in many other ways. At the same time, they have resisted what was Musharraf, come the United States' approach to how to deal with terrorism. And then, of course, also believed, as I mentioned before, that the very source of this terrorism was the adherence to American policies. Now, for most Pakistanis, since, you know, what are they focused on? Obviously, far more important for them, and this was certainly true in the election. The election was not, as many people think, decided on this issue. No, it wasn't. It is public attitudes towards economic issues, and today, of course, prices for just about everything. Inflation is now just short of 25%. Food and energy shortages are having a... They're undermining, really, much of the fabric of society here. Poverty levels are growing again after having dropped. And the idea of, in the major city, having 4 hours of electricity has got to reduce your confidence in your government. And then, of course, corruption is continuously a grievance. Terrorism, in a January 2008 survey of IRI, terrorism was listed as the third most important factor facing the country. Now, that's a reflection of the assassination of the murder of Benazir Bhutto as much as anything else, because the next time when they had a survey and they asked what are the most important issues, it had virtually disappeared, and it was replaced by unemployment, poverty, lack of electricity, water, education, lack of education, corruption. 61%, I should have mentioned this a little earlier, 61% agree that religious extremism is a serious problem. And it's been as high in IRI polls as 74%. Yet only 45% have said that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are a serious concern. Again, you see the confusion, in effect, for them, at least it seems from my vantage point. What the public is unambiguous about in the post-election period and continues to be, perhaps with only diminished degree, is that rather than a military solution, that there be negotiations, that there be a diplomatic and a developmental approach, and that 71% favor political dialogue with extremists and only 13% say no. Now, they're getting a rude awakening because political dialogue in the last month or so has demonstrated that you're not talking to the kind of people who you could deal with earlier by the combination of bribes and threats. The February elections were virtually issueless. Yes, they had party platforms. Nobody paid any attention to this. There is no left and right in Pakistan. Parties really don't differ that much, the two major parties, ideologically. Yes, there are some, and I'll come to that in a moment. But to the extent that any religious parties have a distinct program, of course, it's associated with the any parties have it, it's associated with the religious parties. They have doctrinal and transnational Islamic issues, which do have a regional dimension. For example, the religious parties take a much tougher line on Kashmir and on Afghanistan. Let's see if I can move along quickly here. There are partisan differences in the party. Asif Zardari has lined up with the United States, as most of you know. He's certainly airing or echoing some of the same themes that Benazir Bhutto had, in spite of the state of public opinion. Nawaz Sharif has taken a hard line on cooperation with the United States and on our strategies for counterterrorism, a position not unlike where the religious parties stand. Nawaz's popularity is really, to some extent, based at this point on his better reflecting what public opinion is like, as well as his more so-called more principled position on the Supreme Court justices. We should not rule out, though, that in the coming months here, that Pakistan's relationship with the United States is going to become even more a major factor in the country's political dialogue. Zardari is taking risks at the moment now in identifying with American objectives. He has about 30% support in the country, and his pro-American position undoubtedly is part of this, as well as his well-earned reputation for corruption. By the way, you may have noticed at the inauguration yesterday that President Karzai was sitting side by side with him. That reflects the fact that Zardari is saying the right things, and one of the things that we wanted him very much to say is that extremism in Pakistan is not just Pakistan's problem or the United States' problem, but we understand that we understand the what Afghanistan is going through as well, and having Zardari sit next to him certainly reinforced that. However, I would venture that this did not go over well with the great number of people in Pakistan, because in the last several months, as you all know, there have been exchanges between the two countries which hardly speak of friendship. And there are tripwires, too. The recent attacks by unmanned predator drones, as well as the ground attack in north and south Waziristan, have had an enormous impact on Pakistan public opinion. When you say it's so low, how much lower it can get, but I think that the intensity of feeling has built up. And interestingly, it's across the board, and even the government had to respond to this and to condemn American actions, even though effectively there had been an understanding that surgical attacks were permitted. I want to conclude now just saying a word here about China, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, which is not obviously a near neighbor, but nevertheless behaves like a neighbor. As far as China is concerned, in fact, it's interesting, China, which is the all-weather friend for Pakistan, has very little impact, as far as I've been able to detect, on the political consciousness of people. Yes, there is the assumption that China is there for us, even though China has never really demonstrated that in any important way when the chips were down. But China is not part of the political dialogue there. Iran is also not. Iran has been politically important only when it came, as it has periodically, to Shia-Sunni violence, and the knowledge that Iran has, in the past at least, supported materially Shia and sectarian organizations which have fought Sunni organizations. Now, Saudi Arabia is a different story. It has an enormous presence, in a sense. If you don't believe it, just look at many of the mosques and the madrasas which have come up, funded entirely by Saudi Arabia. Everybody knows that. This has given them a physical presence in the country. In these, of course, the Wahhabi teaching, which goes on in the madrasas, which is hostile to Shia, has promoted friction and violence. Well, finally then, Pakistan's neighbors do matter constantly so, and none more than, of course, India and Afghanistan, and I've spoken mostly about Afghanistan. But the thing we have to take away here specifically with respect to Afghanistan is the fact that what happens in Afghanistan now, Afghanistan's ability to emerge from this period of continued insurgency as a state, and that it not break up as a state, has the most direct consequences for Pakistan. It is inconceivable that if things go badly, well, let me put it this way, if things go badly in Afghanistan, the radicalization in Pakistan really can be expected here to go well beyond what we have seen in the past. And our usual assumptions here about the attitude of most Pakistanis toward militancy and terrorism and so on could very well change. So Pakistan has enormous stake in the outcome in Afghanistan, and that will be, I think, the real test here of this neighborly relationship. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marvin. Dan Brumberg will now react to some of the salient points that have been raised by the three presenters. Dan?
Thanks, Abby. I'm going to react very quickly because I think these excellent presentations deserve to be discussed and debated from the people in the audience first and foremost. I am not an expert by any stretch of the imagination on Pakistan, and in some sense that's helpful because I can come at it from a somewhat outside perspective. I want to say first and foremost that, and this is in part in reaction to what Peter said, that our interest at USIP and our study group on reform and security, when we say security, we mean security obviously in part for the United States, but for security for the regions we're dealing with in the countries. And no one would disagree that the challenge of advancing democracy at the same time addressing internal security challenges in Pakistan has become even more of an urgent problem. And when we created the title for this event, Back to the Future, we all thought about the cycle of Pakistan politics. And while I'm glad to hear Peter providing a somewhat more optimistic perspective on politics and remind us that the parties have survived despite all these challenges, one can't help but feel a little touch of pessimism, particularly in light of the first meeting we had in the group some months ago. There was this hopeful sense of perhaps expectation that the parties could be reinforced politically and that Pakistan would be able to find a political way out of many of the security dilemmas facing it internally. And increasingly, one wonders whether, in fact, that's possible and how Pakistan will face these challenges. I can only say I have one question that I can throw out to everyone here, and that is more about ISI, the security apparatus. We talk about the military, but those of us who look at Pakistan are always reminded that the part of the security apparatus has a certain kind of surreptitious or not so surreptitious relationship with the Islamist extremists, and that poses somewhat of a challenge apart from the military itself. But more broadly speaking, I would only sort of ask, and this is in light of what some of the remarks that Peter made, if you would want to list, and I'll put this out, the two or three aspects of American policy towards Pakistan that you would like to see most clearly change or evolve, what would they be? Let's say two for each of our speakers, because I think the challenge will be here to readdress the Pakistani, any new American government president will be facing this question of how to help Pakistan address security dilemmas while at the same time not opening the door to a reassertion of military control in Pakistan or a further fragmenting of the political scene. So what would be the two or three things that you would suggest that have to be part of any new president's approach to Pakistan? And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much, Dan. Whenever you're making presentations, you're never sure whether you're actually discussing issues that the audience is actually interested in. So the great thing about having a question and answer period is that it gives our presenters and the discussant some sense of the issues that you're really interested in. So we'll open up the question and answer period now, and I think in the interest of getting as many questions as possible, I would perhaps take three questions, a set of three questions, and then go back to the panelists to answer those questions and go back for some more, and I think that way we'll get as many in. Okay.
Thank you. My name is Edward George. I'm with the U.S. Government Accountability Office. I'm curious about the role of the ISI. In news reports, it's been discussed that ISI is an independent entity. It is not governed by the government. And there was the recent incident where it was placed under the control of the Ministry of Interior, I believe, and then it was not. If you could address those two issues, thank you.
My question, I think, should be addressed to Shrija Nawaz. I guess he would be a better person to answer this question. As you mentioned that there's one person, Musharraf, who was able to start a war against India and in Kargil. And then that was one person who could rein in all the militias, Islamic groups who were fighting against Indian forces in Kashmir. And since then, I mean, we haven't seen any serious efforts by these Islamist groups going into Kashmir. But if you go and see in the western borders, I mean, there's over 80,000 Pakistani troops and ISI and the billions of dollars of aid that's coming from the international community. And Pakistani forces are not able to control these Islamists in that region. Many people believe, I mean, these efforts are not serious and Pakistan is not sincere with the international community in controlling these Islamic groups. So what do you think about this?
Hi, I'm Bill Milam from the Woodrow Wilson Center. None of you were assigned the topic of the economy, but from what I hear and what I read the other day in the paper, Anatole Levin's op-ed, for example, it is the economy, stupid, that is really the major issue. Marvin mentioned this in terms of the IRI results. But one commentator has said that if something important doesn't happen on terms of government policy with regard to the economy, that this group, PPP government and whoever it's allied with, won't last more than 6 months. And I wonder if you all share that sort of view, first. And second, if this doesn't increase the odds that we'll see the military back as in turn, and it will be because of popular demand, much shorter than we would have liked to seen in any case.
Thank you. Let me give an opportunity now to our panelists. Suja, perhaps you might want to start off by addressing.
Sure. Let me first acknowledge what Bill said. I think the economy is the wild card, and it is spiraling out of control, and we have not seen within the past 5 or 6 months any credible attempt at finding a sustainable solution for the economy other than trying to go and get some short-term money so that Pakistan can pay its debts and not have to default. I think this is going to be a huge challenge for the country as a whole, and this will also affect the military because as the economic pie shrinks, the military is not going to be able to find the resources that will be able to sustain it at its relatively large level and size. So you're absolutely right. Food inflation of well over 30% and particularly affecting the poorest people who spend more than half their income on food is likely to create serious problems in the cities. And that's where the majority of the population, the politically active population, is now to be found. On Musharraf and Kargil and the role of the Pakistani troops in the alleged continuation of infiltration, I think one needs to be quite clear about that. Despite the fact that Musharraf was responsible for the Kargil adventure, he did at one point reduce or eliminate support for the militant groups that were infiltrating into Kashmir enough for the Indian government itself to acknowledge that the infiltration had slowed down considerably. So we have to recognize that. But I did mention in my opening comments that there is now a troubling trend because of the spontaneous combustion within Kashmir itself caused by the mishandling of the situation within Kashmir by the Indian government. You now have an opportunistic number of these militant groups from the Punjab that were formerly directly under the ISI and are no longer under their direct control that are taking advantage of that situation, and that creates a serious problem. On the ISI itself, I happen to believe that the ISI has never been independent of the government of Pakistan, that the government of Pakistan has used the ISI for various purposes because it is convenient and because it assures deniability. And that it was because of the ambivalence towards the Afghan Taliban that has continued till almost recently, I would say, and I don't know to what extent that has been removed, that the ISI occasionally got caught and that the United States then used that as a stick to beat Pakistan with. I think it's critical for Pakistan as a government and for the military to take a firm decision and to end this ambivalence. Either we are going to support the Taliban or we are not. And if we are not, then all of the entities of the Pakistan government, including the ISI, have to be on the same page. On the notification that was issued regarding the transfer of the entire ISI to the Ministry of Interior to report to the advisor to the Ministry of Interior, I thought that was not a well-thought move. There was no consultation with the military, and given the military's preeminent position within Pakistani politics, it seemed as if it was very badly handled. If there had been discussion and some better understanding of which part of the ISI dealing with the operations within the country that needed to be better coordinated, and therefore the Ministry of Interior should be responsible for those, then there might have been a better resolution of that issue. But the way it was done, it showed that there was a lack of knowledge of how the ISI was set up and how the military operates. And I think it shows the same kind of mistake that Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto had made in 1989 when she tried to remove the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff also by notification without bringing the military in. And that began her conflict with the then army chief. The good thing is that there doesn't seem to be any sign of a conflict with the current army chief.
Bill, I don't think we're looking at a early return of the military. There's a step in between. We all know at currently the military is licking its wounds. The military has suffered a considerable humiliation in its confrontation with the Tariq-i-Taliban and other elements associated with them. And they have been looking for a breather here. They have been the ones that have negotiated those soft deals, which even so have not been able to stick. And so this is what we're viewing here. I say there's a step in between because it seems to me that with Nawaz Sharif's league sitting now outside, they've positioned themselves perfectly for being able to hold this current strange combination of parties which make up the coalition, and all of whom, by the way, have agreed because they've been bought off in one way or another. This is simply having access to power. If the economy, coming back to that, if the economy continues at its current pace and there is the buildup of anger, which is apparently very, very visible in the society, then Nawaz will be able to turn and say that this is what happens when you get an unprincipled government, the government that is only interested in its own affairs, has not addressed the economy. There will, if there's no progress in the borders, there won't be. He can hold them responsible so that we would very likely, I think we, if we had to put money on it, I would say we'll see an election within the year and perhaps reasonably soon. There's only one an election, by the way, in which Nawaz Sharif will easily have a majority. He won't need a coalition. He'll have a majority. He will sweep the Punjab. He will do well to some extent in other provinces. So that's what's anticipated. The only caveat I would have here is that if, because of the economy, the situation gets out of hand and goes into the street, that sets up another scenario. And then the military will move. It doesn't appear that this particular military commander has any particular inkling to rush back in. But, of course, we said that about Zia and we said that about Musharraf, that they were not political types. But whereas both of those two were somewhat easy to read, ultimately, General Kiani remains inscrutable. So it's really a question. But again, I think that we're looking now at the political process paying out and then the military coming back and saying, we've always said this, that the political classes are corrupt, that they are incapable of ruling, and that therefore we return only because there are no other options.
Peter would like to make a short comment.
Sure, the ISI issue, I think, is an interesting one because it just reminds us that surely it was an embarrassment to Zardari, and it may have been a not very well thought out plan. But it also reminds us that the civilian government is not in entire control of the country. I mean, and civilian governments never have been. They've never been in control of the border issues with Pakistan, with Afghanistan. They've never been in control of India-Pakistani relations. They've never been in control of the nuclear program. And they've never been in control of the intelligence services, and that continues. So while we celebrate the return to civilian and more democratic governance, I think we need to remind ourselves that this is really not a complete control of the government that's being exercised by the civilian leadership.
Thanks. Let's take another round of questions.
Before we do that, could we have the panelists' answers to the question posed by the moderator? I personally would be very interested in hearing the comment that he asked for of two recommendations, or however many they want to come up with, about important changes in U.S. policy toward this difficult situation.
All right, good. That, let's begin with Marvin, and then we'll move across.
Well, one which is, at first I thought it was the question, what would we like to see change? And I was going to respond, it would help to see some new faces. It's remarkable how the cast of political characters has not changed. Peter did not mention, but I'm sure he could wax eloquently about the absence of democracy within the parties, the inability of people to enter politics, and we've had a number of people, interesting people, but they could never gain traction here because of the way in which the parties have so monopolized the political scene and have been unwilling to bring in new blood. But as far as what I think we should do, I would come back to Bill Milam here and an article that Anatole Levin has written here about how we've got to come in now. And the Biden legislation addresses this. And this is there will be now a billions for non-military assistance. Up until now, 80% plus of our assistance to Pakistan has been security-related, directly or indirectly. So I think that we have got to demonstrate to the people of Pakistan that our partnership with them is not simply security-oriented, which means our interests and not their interests. And in this situation of some dire circumstances now, this becomes necessary. Secondly, I think if there's any hope that this democracy is going to succeed, we are going to have to put down our markers here as supporting democracy and assuring that the military does not come back soon. We neglected to do this. Everyone in Pakistan knew that our support of democracy was just simply during this period was simply an expression which fit our general policy, but had really no application to Pakistan. And what I would like to see also is government coming in now and being proactive, being able to not simply react and react late to developments, but develop a better capacity here to be able to anticipate change. What I noted, I spent the 4 years I spent in the State Department, it always struck me how we knew things were coming, and we were unwilling here to be able to adapt our policy. We only adapted it when we had no choice, and Musharraf was the perfect example. We only adapted our policy when we were absolutely forced to.
I agree with Marvin. I mean, he made all the points I think that I would actually want to make. Let me just elaborate on a couple of them, though. For a long period of time, the United States and the rest of the donor community really didn't want anything to do with political parties, and that they really stayed well away from them. And we're paying a price for that now, because having neglected parties for the last almost, 9 years, we now have to deal with them in a very, hopefully in a constructive way. But that's difficult to do, having not sort of had much of a relationship with them for a long period of time. During the past, let me give you a couple of examples. During the past election, normally, particularly in a situation like this, what would have happened is that the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, would have funded organizations like IRI and NDI to do a lot of work directly with political parties by helping develop campaign training programs, working with them on sort of their monitoring of polling day activities, a whole host of things that's normally done, as well as working with civil society. AID did nothing like that. What they did was they gave $14 million to one organization to work only with the Election Commission, the one institution that was controlled by Musharraf. A couple months before the election, the State Department sort of stepped in and tried to redress that imbalance and gave both IRI and NDI some additional money. Work that we had been doing 4 or 5 years ago with political parties was all discontinued a couple of years ago. Currently, the only money that we have to work directly with political parties is from the government of the Netherlands, which we have a sizable grant. As far as I know, USAID is putting absolutely no money into work directly with political parties. I think this is a colossal mistake, and I think that they're just going to sort of exacerbate the not very good relationship that they've had with the party leadership for the last 9 years. That's one thing that I think definitely should be changed. Another issue that I think Marvin alluded to was the whole issue of conditionality. I mean, the last time I was in Pakistan, I was having dinner with the ambassador, and who I like a great deal. But when I asked her sort of what was being done with all the, you know, $750 million had just been allocated for the tribal areas, and trying to figure out, how are you gonna spend that money effectively, given that there's no sort of governmental infrastructure within the tribal areas now, and what happened to the $10 million a year that we're $10 billion a year that we've given Pakistan over the last almost a decade, I guess. And she said to me, "Well, you know, we don't do a very good job of tracking that money. I mean, essentially, there's been no accountability in regard to the funding of the Pakistani government. Most of that money has gone to the military, to be sure. But the money that even that money that has been spent on education and healthcare, it has not been spent to the extent that we sort of expected it to be spent. We had benchmarks in regard to What were the expectations in regard to the healthcare system and the education system? None of those benchmarks were met, and no price was ever paid for their not having been met. So some kind of conditionality, I think, is just absolutely essential to making this this work properly.
Shujan, two changes you recommend in U.S. foreign policy to Pakistan?
I don't know if Dan was making it so specific about U.S. foreign policy, were you? Or was two things you'd like to see change?
The reality is here, the interesting thing about Pakistan, for those of us who are not Pakistan experts, is the usual trade-offs we're familiar with in the Middle East, and particularly the Arab world, don't exist. You don't have a population that's widely supportive of Islamic extremism. You have elections that produce parties that are broadly moderate. Yet you have a weak political system, one that's vulnerable to fragmentation and collapse, and you have a U.S. policy which basically securitized our approach to Pakistan at the expense of the political institutions. So we are looking, this is in part what we're doing at USIP, we are looking at sort of strategies for sort of addressing these tensions, and any light you have to share on those particular questions in terms of, the broad sort of answer is, well, the U.S. should support democracy. Well, yes. How does one do that at the same time address the security challenges? And moreover, on the economic front, I think it was just said, greater economic support can breed corruption too in the absence of accountability. So economic challenges have to be met not merely by pumping more funds, but creating a structure by which the U.S. can advance support at the same time not exacerbate the problems of corruption. So there are all kinds of issues, and any insights that our panelists have on addressing these issues that engage U.S. foreign policy would be appreciated.
Thank you. I wanted that clarification because I thought one of the key internal decisions that needs to be made I'd already mentioned, which is that the government of Pakistan should end its ambivalence regarding the Afghan Taliban. And that would help clarify where it stands in the fight against militancy and terrorism. But looking at the U.S., now that you've focused on that angle, I will pick up on the economic aid, and I would say that the U.S. needs to find a better way of getting the money into the hands of the people on the ground, and that having just come back from the region, I know that it is a cash economy, and you really need to function in that cash economy if you're going to buy the support of the locals, particularly in the Northwest Frontier Province and in Fatah. The current system doesn't work because everyone on the ground understands that most of the money tends to come back to Beltway bandits in Washington. You have huge consultancies that rake off the money. And I think we keep talking about the $750 million. This is a long-term project, and it translates to $150 million a year, which is peanuts compared to the needs of Fatah. And I think that's something that needs to be understood, which is where the Biden-Lugar bill comes into play. And the good thing about that is that you need to support the economy not just in the frontier region but also in the rest of the country. And have the kind of benchmarks which I don't think, in fact, were established with the previous aid package. There was no sitting down with the Pakistanis and telling them what the expectations were and when there would be a review and what would need to be done. So no tracking occurred of any of the 10-plus billion that was transferred to the government. And even within the government, I heard complaints in Pakistan that there was no tracking, so a lot of it ended up being used in the central budget. Believe it or not, I heard a complaint from the people in the army saying that they were not being reimbursed by the central government because they'd run out of money. So there's a lot of finagling going on. With a cash economy and by injecting cash into the region, you will, of course, have some corruption. You will have some leakages, but I don't think it'll be more than what you have now, and it'll be much more effective at getting the money into the hands of the locals who know exactly what they want. They want irrigation in Fatah, they want education, they want primary health care. And there are ways of providing it without giving the money over to the government. So I would try and find ways of getting it into the hands of the people without handing it over to the government. I think that would be the most important thing that we could do.
Abby, could I add just one item here? Dan mentioned here security and democracy. And I think that that's a mistake that we made in Pakistan, to treat them as somehow alternatives where we had to make a choice. What we failed to realize in Pakistan was that we could not have the kind of security that we needed, that is the cooperation that we needed, unless there was popular support for it. And by the way in which we conducted our policy, we made it seem as if security could not incorporate democracy. That was the message that we sent. And ideally here, the going to elections would have bridged this now. The sad thing will be if democracy fails, and in doing so does now create a new security problem. But to see them necessarily as a choice here, I think, is where we went wrong.
Thank you. Let's take another round of three questions.
Stanley Cooper with the Cato Institute. Let me just follow up on what Mr. Nawaz just said, because I'm not sure I understand it. How does a foreign government, like the United States, provide assistance to a foreign country, bypassing that country's government, without appearing imperialistic? It seems to me you run into this problem, as particularly given the history of any sensitivity toward imperialism. And particularly in this case, if we're saying, yes, we want you to have a democracy, but we don't trust your democracy enough, we have to bypass it. I mean, no authoritarian government would permit that. And this is like a vote of no confidence. So I just don't understand the operational mechanics, particularly if you're talking about large-scale assistance, providing assistance to a country but nevertheless insisting we are going to bypass your government.
I'm Louis Slovin from the Roosevelt Institution at the University of Iowa. And Peter, you made a comment about opening up tribal areas to political participation and reaching out to them. And I wanted to know a little bit more about that, like how you think that would proceed and whether you see that as having a danger of weakening or destabilizing the system.
My name is Omar. I'm a lawyer from the frontier. I'm a tribal outskirts of Peshawar. I'm here on a holiday, but I had to come and attend this and just see what is all. What a way, exactly. I could go on, but I'll just try. You know, I have a lot of questions, but I'll probably more sound like, you know, an emotion will come out rather than a question. I'm an ex-naval officer and come from a predominant military family. In fact, my father pulled a coup d'etat in 1973, was arrested. So, and I'm a lawyer myself. We stood for the judicial crisis in Pakistan for the last 2 years now. I agree. I think in Pakistan, as a youngster, as a, you know, a man who worries about it, it's the hatred now, the hatred of failure. For us, Allah has failed in so many ways. For us, America has failed so many times. The army has failed. And last time, we tried the MMA, the mullah. The mullah has failed. You see, there is no other option now. Now we're coming back to the same old crooks. They've come over all back again. And they are bound to fail. I do not see that what else is the option. Is there any other option? Because the army will never come back. This is a guaranteed. And this is, I say this because of the hatred. Not because the army is scared. Army is scared not of its failure. Army is scared because of the people. And it realizes for the first time that the respect that they had is no longer there. It is hatred of the common man for the army. For reasons that are a little different, because for reasons that they haven't been able to explain their actions in Pakistan. They took over, they did not explain, they lied. You know, all the time anyway. But my question is there a fourth option? All options have failed so far. What's going to happen in 1 year's time once these people fail? And Nawaz will come in, I agree to that, with the majority, probably 98%, but he will also fail. And then there is no other choice. Then probably a civil law, war or anything of the sort. Do you foresee that?
Well, thank you very much for those questions. I think we could proceed in this way. Perhaps Shuja could respond to the question from our colleague from the Cato Institute about giving assistance while bypassing the government. And then Peter could react to the question from our colleague from the Roosevelt Institution about opening up the tribal areas. And then perhaps all three panelists might want to react to Omar's question about the future of Pakistan and this record of failure. Okay, so soon.
We'll take note of that. I agree with your comment. No, you cannot bypass the government. But what I meant, what I said, and what I meant was that you do not hand over the money to the government and have it deal with. Neither do you handle it the way we are currently handling it, which is where the USAID essentially selects consultants, many of them based in the Washington, D.C. area, who then dole out this money to their favorite NGOs. I think if you find, and there are increasingly a large number of civil society groups in Pakistan, particularly operating within the frontier region, that are very effective, that know the region, that know the language, that know how people function, and you empower them, then the understanding you need to reach with the government is that the money has to go through directly to these groups. And you work out whatever strategy the government wants to see implemented and then follow through. This is the way the international agencies also handle it. They don't simply hand over the money and hope that 10 years later when they go back, things will have happened, which is essentially what the U.S. did after 9/11. I think I'll stop there. I don't know if you want me to comment on Omar's prophecy, but my simple answer is elections and more elections. And I think that's one way of bankrupting a lot of the politicians and allowing the urban intelligentsia to come into the political system.
Thank you. Peter?
In regard to the tribal areas, a proposal was under pretty active discussion to amend the political party law to permit parties to operate freely within FATA and to amend the Federal Crimes Regulation Act that governs activities in FATA. During my last trip, I met with every representative of all the political parties and asked them the question as to whether or not they think it was feasible to open up the tribal areas to sort of normal political activity. And every one of them supported that. I mean, I think it's important to remember that the religious parties have always been active there. They don't do it as political parties. They operate through the mosque. But, you know, they could travel and operate pretty freely throughout the tribal agencies. The other more secular political parties are the ones that have greater difficulty. As a practical matter, I don't know that you could open up all the tribal, every portion of all the tribal agencies. I don't know that you could implement that sort of simultaneously. I think there are probably areas of within each of the tribal agencies in which more or less normal political activity could take place. In remote areas that are mountain valleys of small villages, probably not. But why not do what you can anyway and at least start the process? Because, I mean, the message that's being sent is that, you know, they're not really part of Pakistan. They're sort of in this or kind of no man's land with this semi-autonomous status. And I think that incorporating them more fully into every aspect of political and social life in Pakistan would be a positive thing.
Okay. Thank you. Marvin?
If I could just say a word about the integration, that's not proceeding as one would have hoped. There was a great deal of talk here about integrating the frontier. We're not seeing any indication that that's high on anybody's agenda. And I think we have to face the fact that there are strong elements that don't want to see change, that are perfectly happy with this. For much of this time, the tribal leaders, although they have suffered, perhaps the people have suffered in terms of lack of development, they have enjoyed a certain discretion by being as autonomous as they've been. They've enjoyed this kind of relationship that they've had with the central government. And there are also a great many people who say that this is not what the military and the ISI want. They want to have an area like this that they can operate in. And if it were part of Pakistan, they would be much more constrained. Now, I agree with Shahja in that, yes, elections, elections, elections. And the reason for that is that nothing so represents democracy than the transfer of power peacefully. If you had to single out one aspect of democracy which can sort of encompass others, it's that ability to transfer power. And that's where Pakistan has historically been so lacking. If we can't avoid, the pessimistic answer would be we'll just go into the same cycle that we've been in and things go on and on. But if there can be developed a democratic continuity, if things can change constitutionally, and by and large governments can are able to finish their terms of office, this will ultimately build a more accountable system. And people will come to the conclusion, which they're not now, that if we don't get immediately what we want, we may never get another chance. And that's really what so motivates a lot of the corruption, that you never know when it's going to end, so you better cash in while you can.
Let's take another round of questions.
Hi, thank you. Malou Innocent from the Cato Institute as well. My question for the panel is essentially, how effective is economic aid, U.S. economic aid, to the tribal areas, given the ongoing unilateral missile strikes in the tribal areas as well? I feel it's almost equivalent of asking Iraqi what they think of America's PR campaign in the Middle East. It seems that one policy is sort of nullifying another policy. So just want to get your opinion on that.
Ali Grieb from Enterprise Service. I'm just wondering if the change to a fully democratic Pakistan is ever possible unless you have full civilian control over the military, and is that a realistic proposition? Thank you.
I'm just going to have a comment on this democracy thing. Whenever democracy is curtailed within Pakistan or there is authoritarian rule inside Pakistan, it always gets endorsement from the West. And then IMF comes inside, World Bank comes inside, Pakistan is given a lot of economic aid, and there is no transparency in the economic aid. But once the democracy is restored, all these challenges just come up. So is it not the case that there is an irreconcilable dilemma? There are very complex geopolitical strategic imperatives, and West has very keen interest to see that its own interests are met inside the region, and then Pakistan is used as a conduit for meeting those interests. So I think much of this debate was an inquest of Pakistan, that Pakistan is not doing enough, it's not doing good on war and terror, ISI has a problem. But if you're looking at the history for last 40, 50, 60 years, there is a very complex relationship of the West towards Pakistan's military. So how do we explain that dichotomy? That is my comment, and of course, as a question also.
Thank you. Shijan, do you want to take a stab at those questions? The last one on the military dimension and economic aid, and then also whether you can have really a real democracy without full civilian control of the military?
Yes, I'll try all of them. I'll start with the full civilian control of the military. I think, yes, that is the desirable, but it has to be based on civilian governments that are willing to do the work to understand how the military operates and how it is set up so that it can leverage that relationship and not get into a conflict without being in a strong enough position to resist the military if it gets into a tussle with the civilians. I believe that the Constitution certainly gives it the authority. The question now is how to use that constitutional authority. The current Army Chief has given an opening, but I agree with Marvin's reservations that previous Army Chiefs have given the same kind of assurance and then have found themselves, quote-unquote, forced into taking action. And so that may still repeat. Yes, on the last question, we need a Pakistan-centric policy from not just the West but from the international financial institutions, which quite often do go in line with the main shareholders, after all. Both the World Bank and the IMF, the United States does have a pretty sizable clout, and it uses it effectively as part of its strategic interest in the region. And I think this is where the Biden proposal is now talking about, trying to set up systems that look at Pakistan's needs and not Pakistan as a subset of what the U.S. needs in the region. I think that once that is understood within the country, within Pakistan, there'll be a much more acceptance of U.S. assistance as being untied. How effective will U.S. aid be? Given the current situation in Fatah in particular, anything that has the U.S. stamp on it is really not going to work. And the United States understands that. We have a lot of assistance that is going through other agencies that the U.S. is providing and that is then being transferred into projects on the ground, for instance, schools, even for girls, that are getting local support, but they don't have the U.S.'s seal on it. I think that's the way to begin, to create a kind of a pilot program. And once you know what the people want, and I sat with 23 Maliks in North Waziristan a few weeks ago and asked them what is it they want, and the three things they talked about broadly were irrigation, education, and basic health care. These are the kinds of things that they would want to invest their own time and effort in. But you have to remember, too, that the Maliks, going back to Peter's earlier comment about opening up the political system, the Maliks are a vested interest, and they would lose were you to open up the political system in Fatah. But I happen to think that it's an anachronism which has, in fact, changed to some extent on the ground. You have political parties' flags now flying in Fatah. You can see them, but they're not allowed to operate. And surprisingly, there's no relationship between Fatah and the provincial assembly of NWFP. And that should really be seen as a single economy because people go from Fatah to NWFP for their education, et cetera, and there is commerce. So why are we giving representation to Fatah in the National Assembly and the Senate but not in the Provincial Assembly, and there's no relationship with the provincial government, is beyond me.
Thank you, Peter. Want to have something, given your opening remarks on democracy, do you have any thoughts on the link with the military?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that you're never going to have a full democracy as long as the military is sort of beyond the power of the civilian government. But part of the answer to that, I think, is that, I mean, even with or without a coalition, if the major political parties could come up with a common position with respect to the role of the military, I think that would be very helpful. What you saw in the lead up to the last election was, I mean, thinking about the IRI polls, that although the reputation of the military remained relatively high, it did begin to slide as Musharraf's popularity precipitously declined. I mean, he was down at like 10 or 15% of the population. The military was way above him, but nevertheless, they were on the same sort of downward slope. Well, it seems to me that what the military is very concerned about is their own reputation. And when they have intervened in the past, I think that they probably rightly believed that the civilian governments in power had lost the support of most people, and that their intervention was probably welcomed. In 1999, I think, at least the conventional wisdom is that is, in fact, the case. But, you know, if all the major political parties are able to mobilize public opinion in support of civilian authority, I think that would be an important bulwark against military intervention in the future.
Good, thank you. Just give the final word to Marvin.
Well, just on this question of the military also, I think we have to appreciate the fact the military is accustomed to being top dog. And it's not a position, they're not going to take a position which in any way diminishes their institutional power. However, if the military is convinced that the state of Pakistan is failing, then the military has a vested interest in trying to shore that up in any way possible. So in that sense, if the military believes, for example, that the people of Pakistan want democracy, if it believes that it has to reduce its own budget, perhaps, in order to shore up the economy, it will do that. It will do that. But the military has spent all of these 65 years or so of Pakistan's history accustomed now, by and large, to getting what they want. And it's going to be hard to go past. Let me just a final comment here on the tribal areas. We've got a real problem, and it's been one for a long time. We need to convince the people of Pakistan that we are doing the right thing for them. We've sometimes been able to break through, and everybody mentions the earthquake, how we brought in our military at that point and were able to demonstrate our military's capacity to undertake humanitarian actions, which were greatly appreciated by the people of Pakistan. I was there during that period, and it was rather remarkable to see finally people having a good word to say about the United States and what it can do. It didn't last long because we soon bombed on the frontier and lost that. But our dilemma has been that, as it is now in the frontier and elsewhere, we're afraid to put our label on things. It used to be aid used to have, remember that logo where you two hands clasped, you know, a friendship. We dare not take credit for the things that we may be doing. And that's, we've got to somehow dig our way out of that. There are sometimes very practical ways in which you can demonstrate this. Were we in a position, for example, now as we were 30 years ago, to come in with a large PL-480 program to relieve the wheat? We are making some wheat sales available, but I mean on a massive scale, the way we did with India and Pakistan in the 1950s, for example. Were we in a position to do that? I think we could demonstrate, and that's really where we've got to be. If we need to keep this partnership going, it's absolutely essential for our global strategic interests that this partnership not come apart. And the only way we're going to do it is to march back up to the point where there's some trust between the, the two countries. At the moment, that's what's so severely lacking.
I think this has been a very rich and full discussion, and I thank you, the audience, for being such active participants this morning as we've discussed a range of issues relating to what is going on within Pakistan and the implications for the region and also the implications for U.S.-Pakistani relations. I'd also like you to join me in thanking our panelists and discussion for their excellent contributions this morning. So thank you very much.